Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest Empire Podcast interview special. One-to-One, John and Yoko is the latest film from Kevin MacDonald, the renowned Scottish filmmaker who works equally adeptly in both documentaries and fictional narrative. This falls firmly into the former category and sits alongside some of his other work like One Day in September, Touching the Void, Marley, and Whitney. Like those last two films, One-to-One, John and Yoko is about a musical genius, John Lennon, of course, but it isn't a biodoc. Is that a word? Have I just coined that word? Has anyone used that word? Biodoc? It's like biopic, but a doc? Does that work? I'm going with it. Instead, it's partially a concert film bringing you remastered footage and audio of a benefit concert that Lennon and Ono performed at Madison Square Garden, the only full-length gigs that Lennon performed after he left the Beatles. There was one gig in the afternoon and one gig in the evening. But it's also an in-depth snapshot of a year in the life of John Lennon and his wife, Yoko Ono, and that year is 1972, to be precise, the same year, by a strange quirk of coincidence, in which the offence of MacDonald's One Day in September, which was about the terrorist attack on the Israeli team at the Munich Olympics, also took place. It was a year when the couple had just relocated to New York City from England, and they were trying to carve out something of a normal life for themselves. Not so easy when you're some of the most famous people on the planet. But they also became involved at that time in American politics and with a number of interesting people and radical groups. And in One-to-One, John and Yoko, MacDonald adroitly fills in the political context surrounding Lennon and Yoko's actions, as well as the personal context. And also, he had access to a treasure trove of never-before-heard phone recordings featuring the pair, which really humanizes them. In this extended interview, I talked to MacDonald on Zoom about the documentary, his intentions behind it as a filmmaker, and much, much more. The film is out now, today, Friday, 11th of April, in cinemas around the UK. So maybe go see it after listening to this. I had a great time talking to Kevin MacDonald. Hopefully you will too. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of One-to-One, John and Yoko, Kevin MacDonald. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be here.
And nice to have you. Where is here for you at the moment, Kevin?
I'm out at Three Mills Studios out in East London, where I'm prepping a movie which I'm going to start shooting in about 4 or 5 weeks. I'm a bit terrified. Yeah, I've just come out of a conference of talking about how we're going to shoot a big action scene on the tube when you have to shoot on, you know, almost every frame in the storyboard seems to need to be shot somewhere else. You know, it's a real jigsaw puzzle, but it's the first time I've ever filmed in London and where I live. Uh-huh. Really, I filmed anything big, and I'm hoping it's going to be a real portrait of the city. That's the idea.
That's good, because people who live in London, you know, we're very harsh in films, portrait of London geography, Kevin. So are you going to make sure that?
Well, I'll tell you what, this film, I'm a documentarian first and foremost, but this is a feature film. It's an action film, but I'm a stickler for the geography. In fact, the whole thing is about a woman who runs across London. She runs from basically very near my house, funnily enough, up in North London, and she runs down through Kentish Town and Camden and King's Cross and the city and down to South London. And so you basically see the whole city through the course of this film.
Amazing. So she's not going to come out of Waterloo Station and suddenly be in Greenwich. That sort of thing.
She is absolutely not. You're going to be able to look at this and just be, you know, looking for problems, and you're not going to see a single one. It's all going to be, I'm not saying it's going to be a good film, but it's going to be very geographically satisfying.
They'll put that in the poster, geographically satisfying. Well, I wish you all the best with that. But of course, you are a documentarian. We're here to talk about a documentary, One-to-One, John and Yoko, which I thought was really, really fascinating. How did this start for you?
I was approached by the producer, Peter Worsley, who had been trying for many years to get the rights to this kind of mythic concert that John did in 1972 with Yoko, the One-to-One concert. And this is the only concert, the only full-length concert that John gave after leaving the Beatles. It's an incredibly valuable document, but it was only ever released on VHS in 1986. And the reason for that was because, and you can see that version of it on YouTube, the reason that it's you know, had never been properly seen or heard is because it was so terribly recorded by Phil Spector, the infamous record producer, who was a great friend of John's and obviously worked on Let It Be and all sorts of things. And he was in charge of recording it. And I think he had one too many martinis before he started. And it was so mushy and messy and it, you know, really didn't represent John's performance well. So it was kind of buried. But in the last couple of years, Sean Lennon, with the advent of amazing AI technology and sound remixing technology, which has come on so far in the last few years, is able to clean it all up, separate off all the channels and remix it. And so that was really the impulse to do this. It's like, this legendary concert, which is the only time you're ever going to see John in a big venue playing some of his classic songs, is finally available to be used. So it was like, how can you make a film? He said to me, you know, make any film you like around the concert. So I thought, well, so much done about the Beatles. We're going to have to do something really different and really something that really kind of like takes you off in a more filmic direction that isn't a bunch of old white dudes reminiscing about the 70s.
True. And the direction that you jumped off in is really, really interesting, because you take the concert as a kind of almost like as a framing device. You return to the concert throughout the film, but you use the concert as a jumping off point to examine this very specific period of time, to give a lot of context to the early 70s and to give a lot of context to John and Yoko's situation at that time. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah. So it's sort of like, as well as the concert, we've got sort of two other strands. One is John and Yoko's own lives at that period. It's a very interesting period. They've arrived in New York, really running away from the kind of trauma of the Beatles, and also running towards New York because they were trying to find Yoko's daughter, Kyoko, who had been kidnapped by her ex-husband. So they're searching for her. They're sending out private detectives. So that's one thing that's going on. And then at the same time, you've got this amazing period in American history, which is a really tumultuous period, with so many aspects of it that really, as I started to work on the film, I realized that reflect on today. So you've got a foreign war, which America's involved with, which is riling the campuses. Obviously, in those days, it's Vietnam, and now it's Gaza. You've got a right-wing populist president who is running for office and who gets shot on camera, which is George Wallace then, and you know who now. You've got the first black woman running for president, Shirley Chisholm. You've got early environmentalism. You've got a lot of talk about race and, you know, how do we fix the race problem in America? So many things that you recognize. And that was really startling to me. It's like, this is a film which is about 1972. But it's also could be about today, you know. So there are those three aspects of it. There's sort of the world of 1972 as it plays out on TV, and John and Yoko kind of watching TV in their apartment and they're seeing all this stuff. And then there's the concert, and then there's their personal lives and what they're going through in the aftermath of the Beatles and trying to figure out, what do we do with our lives? Mm. How do we use our fame to make the world a better place? Or, you know, how do we continue being artists when we've already achieved so much, you know, in the case of John. I mean, it's amazing to me that John's 30 or 31 when in the period that we're making this, and he's already, the Beatles is finished and over, he's 31. I'm like, oh my God, I was barely, you know, barely out of college. That didn't know me. It's sort of amazing.
It's incredible. And you've got so much wonderful archive footage as well, not just footage, but you have audio recordings also of phone calls that John and Yoko were recording for posterity, for out of paranoia. Why were they recording these things?
I think a bit of posterity, or a bit of sort of Yoko being an artist and thinking you should catalog everything in your life, and she got very into the idea, I think, of recording their phone calls. But also, I think for John, they were recording their phone calls because they were convinced, and it turns out correctly, that the FBI were bugging them, and they wanted to have their own record of what they were saying, so that the FBI couldn't say, well, you said, let's plant a bomb at the Capitol. when John obviously would have the phone, his own phone call, his own recording, and say, no, I didn't. But it's an amazing thing. So these phone calls, they only did it during the period that our film is about, you know, 1972. And nobody had heard them before. Even the family hadn't heard. They were sitting in a box somewhere. It said, you know, phone calls, 1972. And it was only halfway through our edit that the archivist who works for the estate got in touch and said, oh, we found this box of stuff. It's about your period that you're making the film. Are you interested in hearing it? And of course, I was like, yeah, of course I'm interested in hearing it. And they sent it over like 30 hours of recordings. And they're totally unique and fascinating because you get to really hear what they're like when they're just, you know, shooting the breeze with somebody on the phone, whether with John's manager or with sort of, you know, art collectors who phone up, or their assistant, or, you know, this crazy guy, AJ Weberman, who was stalking Bob Dylan. And who is still stalking Bob Dylan, because I read an article actually about AJ Weberman that he even went to the recent Dylan biopic, Complete Unknown, and sort of went to the cinema and was apparently in New York and was yelling and insults at the screen throughout. There was a report about it in the New York Times.
Oh my God.
Anyway, it's about this crazy bunch of characters that you get on these phone calls that you know, gives you such a sense of really intimate sense of their lives at that particular point in time.
Yeah, that Weberman call is really interesting because Yoko calls up to essentially trying to persuade him not to stalk Bob Dylan, and then John comes on the phone. I just love that dynamic. You get the sense, you know, Yoko, give me the phone, and then he comes on. He's a little bit more direct with him.
I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it? But it's fascinating to me that here's this very kooky guy who's convinced, you know, it's a conspiracy theorist, basically, AJ Weberman, who's convinced that Bob Dylan is somehow, you know, working for the man now and is, you know, he's a millionaire. I hate him. He's buying up buildings. He's, you know, he's a capitalist. And which was an odd thing to complain to John and Yoko about. You know, I think that they were both could be accused of the same things. But the fact that they were taking him seriously and spending all this, there's so many phone calls with this guy where they're trying to persuade him to apologize to Bob Dylan because they want Bob Dylan to go on tour with them on this big tour that they think is going to swing the election and against Nixon, and that Nixon's going to be defeated in the 1972 presidential election. Of course, they don't manage to persuade Bob. Bob's too insulted by AJ Weberman's insults and whatever. He won't go on tour with them. And you know, then you know, all the yippies, who are this radical left party, who they're friendly with their leader called Jerry Rubin, kind of implode, and you know, they fall out with everyone. I mean, it's the usual story of radical politics, I suppose.
So you're halfway through the edit, you are presented with these tapes. Does that provoke a radical re-edit, or did you drop them in seamlessly?
No, we didn't drop them in seamlessly, but it didn't. The structure stuck. The structure of what we had stuck. But I think it just gave, I think it, what had been a little less accessible, a little less personal and intimate, became much more personal and intimate. And therefore, I think became less of an art piece in a way, and more of something which has this really strong biographical element. And I think one of the things that I think is surprising to me when they watch the film is that it's actually very emotional, even though it's sort of a collage. It's a kind of artistic movie. It's actually, I say that, I said, when I say artistic, made it sound really insulting for something to be artistic. I didn't mean to say it like that. But you know what I mean? It's not a mainstream approach. And yet emotionally it's very mainstream. And I think that comes from these phone calls and just the sense you get of them as people.
Yeah.
You know, simple as that.
And the sense you get also, I mean, the title alone says it and suggests it. Yes, John and Yoko. I think a lot of documentaries, a lot of literature about, a lot of writing about Lennon over the years has sought to diminish Yoko's contribution. You know, there's still the phrase, Yoko can be used as a sort of directorially to describe someone who's splitting up a band or a great thing. And this movie, I think, goes to bat for Yoko in the most wonderful way. It says this was an equal partnership. They were two halves of the same coin.
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly right. I mean, that there was this kind of almost symbiotic nature of their relationship. I mean, almost an unhealthy degree at times, I think. But you also, you get to hear in the film a bit of Yoko's perspective on the Beatles, but you also get to hear a little bit from her, particularly at the end, about how hard it was to be married to somebody who the whole world is worshipping, and how it made her lose her own confidence, how she started to stutter, how she, you know, was made to feel like she was stealing your monument. That's what she says, a really memorable phrase, actually. And then she says, yeah, I was, when I moved from Britain to America, I was upgraded from a bitch to a witch. And, you know, and then she talks about her missing child, and you really feel for her, and you think, God, what is it like as a mother to have your child kidnapped and not to see them for years and years and to be searching and not be able to find them? And I think that you get really close to her in hearing about those things and seeing her in a much more human way. I mean, I think part of the, you know, I think Yoko probably wasn't very good at presenting herself to a kind of mainstream audience. You know, she was very intellectual, very demanding and highly educated. And I don't think, you know, she was taking PR advice about, if you want to come across better, behave like this, you know. So, but I think when you sort of just look at her as a human being and what she's gone through in this period in particular, it's, you know, it's really heartrending, actually.
Mm. Were you a Beatles fan? Were you a Lennon fan? How much of the stuff did you know going into this?
I wouldn't say I knew, you know, I'm not, there were Beatles fans and there were Beatles fans. I was a Beatles fan. I was 12 years old when John Lennon died. And that's a very, you know, in, you know, a period of your life, you're entering your teens, the musical influences you get at that point really go deep and really are significant to you. And it's a 1980, he's shot. Mm. And everything that he did went into the top 10. I bought every single record of his. I bought, bought the books and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I was a huge fan in my teenage years. And I think that sense of rebellion, sticking it to the man, that sense of being the true heart of the Beatles. I don't know if he really was, you know, the brilliant one, the one with integrity. You know, that was certainly how I felt about him. I really grew up with him as a huge musical influence on me. But I wouldn't say in the last 30 years or so, I'm not bringing out the Plastic Ono Band LPs and listening to them every weekend. I'm not sort of following every ins and outs of the latest research into Lennon and Ono, whatever. But that's to say that they were very important to me as part of my teenage years and forming me, I suppose. So that was when I was approached and asked to do this, and my first impulse was to go, there's nothing else to say. You know, I'm a bit scared of trying to do something that's just like, oh God, another film about Beatles, another film about John Lennon. It's like, so I really felt like I had to do something that provided something new and was a different sort of approach. And I was just really lucky that both Sean Lennon and the financiers at Mercury Studios were really supportive of that. And they were like, they were into it and into the idea of trying to do something different, which showed you a different way to make a film about a great artist.
How long did it take you to come up with that take? Did you say to Sean and everyone else who was involved, just give me 2 weeks and I'll come back with a definitive yes or definitive no?
It basically did take me, about 20 minutes, I think.
Oh, that's not 2 weeks. That's pretty good.
No. I mean, and I think it took me a few days because my original impulse was that I'd actually had said no to another Beatles film a few years ago. And for the same reason, it's just like, I don't know what I can do that's different here. But when I watched the concert and heard how good the remix was or how good it was going to be, I thought, oh, wow, this is something I would be crazy not to make a film which uses this amazing, the one concert he gives after the Beatles. I mean, that is an amazing thing to have at your disposal. And it's really powerful and he's fantastic in it. And so that was the thing I thought, oh, I'm not sure I can say no to that. But then I read this interview with John where he said how much he loved TV and how he spent most of his first years in America just sitting watching TV, flicking from channel to channel. Even when he wasn't watching, he'd have it on and he'd say, that's my window on the world. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. You know, it's like he was scrolling TikTok for 3 years or something, and just that was how he was learning about the world, like an alien, you know, coming from another planet and learning about this strange place that America was in 1972. And I thought, oh, that could be interesting. So I'll do it through the TV. And then I thought, I'll rebuild their apartment. And it all sort of came in a flash of kind of like, okay, that's what I did. So they presented that to Sean and he said yes. And it basically, the film is pretty much what I pitched to him. And that doesn't always happen in documentary. Often you sort of, you start thinking you're going to do one thing and then it becomes something completely different. But in this case, we did stick very closely to the original conception. I'm really pleased that the film is going out on IMAX. And I didn't think that's where our destination was, but I think when I first saw the transfer to IMAX, I thought this is where it belongs, because it really feels, and there's concert sections when you watch it on that huge screen surrounded by the sound of crowd, and you really feel like you are there in Madison Square Gardens in 1972. And it made the film feel very, very different, because it made it feel more visceral somehow, more kind of the immediacy of that. The concert element of it felt really, really sort of incredibly privileged to watch it, I suppose. It's like, gosh, he was an artist at the height of his powers, but this is the only time he did this. Yeah. And you've sort of brought up short by that.
Yeah, it's an incredible performance. He sounds absolutely amazing in the cleaned up audio as well. And honestly, as well, that gave me a sense of sadness watching it, because I'm a Beatles fan as well. And when I watched Peter Jackson's Get Back, I just wanted to reach through the TV and bang their heads together and go, get on, get, you know, your friends, stop arguing. And with this one, there's this sense of sadness. This is the only time he did this, and he was in such fine voice, and he was in such good fettle. He had his reasons, obviously, for not playing, but yeah, it's so sad.
That's exactly what I feel every time I watch it. It's like, oh my God, you were so good. It's not like, because you think of the Beatles as a studio band, but you forget that they toured for years and years, and they were incredibly good musicians. And here is John playing with, you know, a basically high class pub band from New York, you know, the Elephant's Memory Band, they were called, and they became his kind of his house band. And they're pretty good, but they're not the level of the Beatles. And yet he pulls this performance together. You just feel the force of his personality at the center of this. He gives he's in such great voice. He's ad-libbing the whole time. He's being funny. He's been, you know, it is just, I come away always feeling sad, thinking, yeah, why did you not do it again? Why did you, you know, why you had, even if you were going to die in 1980, you could have gone on tour. You could have, you know, enjoyed yourself doing this, but no, he didn't.
No, absolutely not. He only did one Beatles song as well.
Come Together. Yeah, that's the only one. That's the only one he did. And I think he did that because he wanted to give the fans something. But then he does, you know, he does all his other hits.
Yeah.
You know, Instant Karma, and he does obviously Imagine, Give Peace a Chance, all the great songs from his, you know, his first three solo albums.
Yeah. A couple of lovely covers in there as well. He sounds absolutely amazing.
Yeah, The Hound Dog. I love The Hound Dog, you know, which we sort of associate with Richard Nixon, you know, and we found all this wonderful Super 8 footage that his one of his chief advisors was an amateur DP and loved shooting Super 8. And there's hours and hours and hours. It's an amazing thing. Actually, it's probably a whole documentary we made with that, actually, in the Nixon Presidential Library. And it was beautiful stuff, actually. There's amazing shots on the helicopter and shots of him with Mao in China and stuff. It's amazing.
It's great. Yeah. Kevin, I'd like to go in a couple of seconds, but I just want to ask about Yoko, your interaction with her, how involved was she in this?
Not at all, Yoko. I didn't speak to Yoko. Uh-huh. She has handed over all responsibility for the John Yoko archive to her son, to Sean. And I understand she's seen it and liked it, but I haven't had any communication with her. She's very old now, you know, yeah. And I think she's taking it very easy and not engaging with the world as she once was. So, I'd love to have a conversation with her about it. I once sat behind her. I went to see the premiere of the Scorsese film about George Harrison.
Oh yeah,
and I found myself sitting behind her, and she wore her big black hat all the way through the screening, like it's a 10-gallon hat. And I spent the entire time staring at this hat, but didn't even see a tiny little bit of the screen. I wasn't complaining, because I thought, I'll get a story out of this.
This will be good for a podcast in a few years' time.
This will be good for a podcast one day.
Amazing. And of course, Kevin, with this movie, in a strange way, I don't know that anyone on this earth has chronicled 1972 in the way that you have chronicled it. Did that occur to you at all when you were making this, that this is... You're coming at the, obviously, you're coming at the year in a very, very different way than you did in One Day in September, but this
Yes, it did occur to me that obviously, you know, what is it about, there's obviously something Freudian there that I'm attracted to the year 1972 when I was 5 years old. But, because yes, this is the second film that I've made set in that period and set that year. And we had a lot of discussion about whether we should include some footage from the Munich Olympic Games massacre in the film as part of the collage of things. And, you know, it felt a little too on the nose in certain ways. So we decided not to, also because we were very conscious of trying to show people things that they maybe hadn't seen before, trying to be a fresh view. You know, you're showing footage of the Vietnam War and you want to show new stuff or things that sort of show it from a slightly different angle so that it feels fresh. And you're not just still going to the same usual sources and the same imagery. And with the Munich Olympic Games massacre, I know the footage back to front. I know what exists. Yeah. And I knew there was nothing new and interesting. Obviously, I don't know what else was happening in 1972 that I can make a film about or something.
To Wikipedia, quick. Kevin, I'm going to let you go. Usually what I do at this point is I ask people what's next, but we know what's next for you. It's the yes. Runner. Is that the name of the film?
That's the Runner. That's the film where we're running across London. We're going to start shooting in a few weeks, and then it'll be out next year.
All right. So if you are in London and you see Kevin MacDonald running past you with a camera, do not be alarmed. It's just normal, natural behavior. All good. I wish you all the best with that, sir. Thanks so much for your
time. Thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
Okay, that was Kevin MacDonald talking about The Runner at the end, and obviously for most of the interview, One-to-One, John and Yoko, which is out now at cinemas across the country. And as you heard Kevin MacDonald say, it can also be found on certain IMAX screens. So do check the IMDb or whatever app you use, or a newspaper. Do people still use newspapers? But whatever app you use to find out what's on at your local cinema, check that and see if it is on at your local IMAX. And if you can make it there, it is well worth it. If you can do that, believe me. All right, that is enough for me. Thank you so much for listening to this. The regular Empire podcast is out right now. And if you don't subscribe to our supporter specials, I can thoroughly recommend that as well. empire.supportingcast.fm, £3.49 a month. And you get a whole bunch of supporter specials every single month. All right, that's enough for the shameless plugging for me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.